From Johannesburg to Jerusalem, the world is always changing, growing and innovating. Join Benji Shulman for the next hour as he brings you the trendsetters, the thought leaders and those creating news before it happens. Only on the New Blue Review, your favorite Jewish culture and current affairs show. Every Monday at 9 a.m. right here on 101.9 Chai FM.
You're listening to 101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman. This is the New Blue Review. Welcome to the show on this Monday morning. Hope everyone had a fantastic weekend. And I don't think that we've been on. I think we have. But I hope that you had a fantastic Yom Kippur and are looking forward to the rest of the week. I see that the jacarandas are out, so if you haven't started studying for your exams, I suggest you do so. Otherwise, I just suggest you enjoy the jacarandas, because it is one of the things that makes Johannesburg a city to live in, are these beautiful trees that we have out in the world. Now, let's talk about what is going on the show today. We're going to be talking heritage a little bit later on with the Heritage Foundation. David Fleminger from the Heritage Foundation is going to be talking to us, because one of the debating things that has come out, or debates that has come out of the issue of the city wanting to convert Leila Stanton Drive into Leila Khaled Drive, is what damage that might do to the heritage of the city. And it's an interesting question about how heritage works in general. So we're going to be having David Fleminger from the Joburg Heritage Foundation on about that. And then we're going to be talking about state capture. We're going to be talking about the Guptas. We're going to be talking about a new book on how all of that works. And we're going to be finding out what is going on there, a new book on the issue of how corruption is working in our country and our city. So that is also what is coming up. You should be ready for it. It should be a lot of fun. And we're very, very looking forward to being part of it with you for the next hour. If at any time you want to be part of the show, 34519, that is the SMS line. And you can be part of it. We're looking forward to it. I am Benji Shulman. This is 101.9 Chai FM.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 Chai FM. I am Benji Shulman, and this is the New Blue Review. Welcome back to the show. Now, as you will know, we live in a country which is unfortunately struggling with a wave of corruption that goes really to the very top of the society. And we see it every day in our newspapers and in our news broadcasts. But we've spent very little time trying to understand exactly what the phenomenon is all about. And so there is a new book that has been written called The Super Cadres, Misrule in the Age of Deployment under the ANC. And the person who's written it is Peter Du Toit. He is a journalist, a political journalist, an investigative reporter, and also an author of a number of other books, including Enemy of the People, The ANC Billionaires, and The Stellenbosch Mafia. And the new book is all about some of the corruption issues that we are seeing at the moment, but also where they came from. And so it's a very important topic, and great to be discussing it. And so Peter, welcome to Chai FM. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hello, Benji. Good to be speaking with you again.
Yes, absolutely. It's a real pleasure, and thank you for being part of the show. Peter, as I mentioned before, you've written a number of books, the Stellenbosch Mafia, the ANC Billionaires. You do a lot of investigative journalism. You like, in my view, to seem to write about big man politics when you do your sort of author. What attracts you to a topic such as this?
Well, Benji, first up, you know, I've been doing this for 22 years this year. So I've been lucky enough to as a working journalist cover, you know, more than 2/3 of democracy in the country, which is it's a great privilege to be working as a journalist during this time. After you've done this for 20 odd years, you know, you've seen some stuff. You've experienced some big turning points in our democracy, in the development of our democracy, and that puts you in a position where you are able to, I think, you know, write about these things with a measure of authority. First of all, because you were literally there, and second of all, because you've come to know the political actors who are involved. And I think the onus is on journalists, and there's a big responsibility on us to try and document the direction of travel as we go along, Benji.
Now, I want to start off with maybe the crux of the book, actually. I mean, the title is The Super Cadres. And we hear this word often in South African media. You'll hear it, commentators, different people talking about cadres. And I often get the sense that it's used almost as a byword for nepotism or just general corruption, or maybe even just a way of describing people that sort of sounds like the 1950s, you know, in some sort of communist paradise, something like that. But your contention in the book is that actually the ANC understands the idea of cadres and cadre deployment in not just a very specific way, but a specific way that they write down and which drives the organization. And I get the sense that sometimes people, well, at least according to a definition, don't necessarily understand that. So maybe start off by when the ANC talks about cadres, what are they actually saying?
Well, Benji, first up, you know, the title is an echo of a book that appeared in 1978, also with Jonathan Wall Publishers, and it was titled The Super Afrikaners. And the book was about how the Afrikaner Broederbond went about appointing their minions in certain key positions in the apartheid state, which enabled the Afrikaner Nationalist Project to flourish. And when the Super Afrikaners appeared in 1978, it caused a massive furor because it ripped open the veil of secrecy behind which the Broederbond was able to function. And it ripped open the veil of secrecy around how the Broederbond was able to dominate South African and Afrikaner nationalist politics. So it's an echo of that book, and the Super Cadres tries to replicate this, or I attempt to replicate this, in an African nationalist context. You know, the Afrikaner nationalists lost power in 1994. They were replaced by a new brand of nationalism, which was African nationalism. But the way in which they went about it was, you know, the similarities are quite obvious. Cadres refer to how ANC deployees refer to each other. You know, they are still very much marinated and rooted in Marxist-Leninist theory, even though they might not live it. You know, that's part of their, it's very much part of their rhetoric as the erstwhile governing party. So they refer to each other as cadres, which is a Marxist-Leninist term which refers to colleagues and deployees. So that's how they operate. And the purpose of the book was to explain how cadre deployment works. Cadre deployment, as I argue in the book, I believe, is at the absolute center of the malaise that we continue to face in this country.
Now, the difference, I suppose, though, between the Broederbond kind of conception of how to run the state and the ANC one is that it's not necessarily all that secret. The Broederbond was a secret society, whereas you have this very amusing anecdote where in the book where you go and speak to Ben Turok, who is a, I don't know if he's alive anymore, but an ANC MP and very in charge of some of these thoughts, and you ask him a bunch of questions, and he says, look, Peter, I'm not wasting my time with you anymore. We've written it all down in our documents. Go and read them. And you said that you found exactly all the answers that you have in there. And indeed, cadre deployment is in documents that the ANC debates and discusses every single time it has a conference. Nothing secret about it.
No, of course. Look, not all the comparisons hold, but the broad theme of an organization that takes charge of the state and government and which demands absolute loyalty to the organization first rather than the constitution or the country, that's the main similarity. You know, so that's where I think the touch points between Afrikaner nationalism and the Broederbond and African nationalism and the ANC works very well. But yes, look, the ANC took a much publicized decision in 1997 to make cadre deployment official party policy. It was done at their conference in Mafeking. It was It was conceptualized while Nelson Mandela was still ANC president. It was implemented by Thabo Mbeki, and the first chairperson of the deployment committee was in actual fact Jacob Zuma. But what we did not realize in 1997, and I speak to journalists who were working back then, was the insidious nature of what cadre deployment was to become. Of course, you know, when the democratic government came into being in 1994, the ANC, you know, given a mandate by the electorate, they had to appoint certain people into certain positions to be able to execute the mandate that they were given from the electorate. And that's normal. That happens in any functioning democracy, and that's how it should be. But cadre deployment went much further, Benji. You know, it set as its purpose the complete takeover of the state and government, where you have party deployees being deployed at every level of government, in every position of leadership in state agencies like the National Prosecuting Authority and others, and as the deployment committee policy demands, it demands absolute loyalty to the party first from those deployees, and that's where the problem occurred, Benji.
So in other words, it's not just that you might have someone like we've seen some of these debates in now with the DA administration, people saying, oh well, you know, you've got this person who's in the minister's office and they were like ideologically aligned. It's not actually that. It's almost like, I mean, to take into the extreme, that it's like almost the cleaner is an ANC member and owes his job job more to the ANC than to cleaning the building.
Well, that's exactly it. Look, the oft-mentioned example that you referred to just now was DA leader John Steenhuisen appointing people in his office, and you know, individuals like Robin Kavanagh, who's someone that causes enormous division and is a problematic figure, I think. You know, but it was Steenhuisen's right to do that. It's in the minister's office. Every single minister has the leeway and has the authority to make political appointments. Now, that's not normal. Oh, that's not abnormal. That's absolutely normal. You know, you can argue with the appointment, but that's not the prerogative of the minister. What cadre deployment is, Benji, is not only is the DG and the deputy DG ANC members, but the senior bureaucrats are, the mid-level bureaucrats are, the low-level bureaucrats in a government department are all cadres who are appointed in terms of the cadre deployment policy. Not only at national government level, but at provincial and municipal level as well. So it covers all three levels of government. Not only government, but agencies of the state, like the National Prosecuting Authority, like the South African Revenue Service, and a whole host of institutions that are supposed to support democracy, but which have been subjugated to the ANC. That's the problem with cadre deployment.
Absolutely. We're talking to Peter du Toit today. He's a reporter, a journalist, and an author of a new book called The Super Cadres. And we're chatting to him on 101.9 High FM.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 Chai FM, talking to Peter du Toit today from a variety of newspapers and journalist backgrounds, but more so an author of a new book called The Super Cadres, ANC Misrule in the Age of Deployment. Now, Peter, one of the interesting kind of, I suppose, logical follow-ons from the discussion that we had around the nature of cadre deployment is that you referencing the first time this being codified is in 1997. So that predates not only Cyril Ramaphosa, it even predates Jacob Zuma. In other words, it's almost, I suppose, not quite the term of Mandela, but certainly early term of Mbeki. And if this is the case, then this issue of corruption was not just 9 wasted years under Jacob Zuma. There's actually a continuum here that has been almost from the start in terms of how the ANC has run the country, a problem in terms of the way in which they view the state.
Well yes. You know, I argue in the book that, you know, the years of state capture and the institutionalized nature of corruption that we are dealing with at the moment, the roots of that lie in the 1990s, the latter half of the 1990s, and that was under Nelson Mandela as president. where I think a culture of impunity was established, Benji. I think a culture of the ANC's the interests of the ANC's ANC above all other interests started to triumph. You know, if you look at the first couple of corruption scandals, which by today's standards looks rather trifling, the Sarafina 2 scandal, the Travelgate scandal, Stella Sekou, who was a minister in the Mandela cabinet, who was accused of corruption by Bantu Olomisa, that type of thing, it's piffling if you compare it to what we're experiencing today. But the knee jerk and the almost immediate reaction from the ANC under the leadership and specifically by Nelson Mandela was to defend the ANC by accusing the media and the opposition of racism, and was to put the interests of the ANC above all other interests. Now I think the establishment of this culture of impunity started then, and it simply accelerated in the 2000s when you started seeing the arms deal, the way in which the government and the ANC handled the arms deal. You know, it was a hop, skip, and a jump to state capture, I argue, from the way in which they handled that. So yes, I don't think you can separate Cyril Ramaphosa from the 1997 decision to adopt cadre deployment as party policy. You can't separate Nelson Mandela from that. You can't separate Thabo Mbeki from state capture, because I do think Thabo Mbeki gave us Jacob Zuma. Jacob Zuma birthed state capture. You know, so I think the ANC needs to be taken to task for this, and I think they need to be held accountable for it. You know, there were individuals in the ANC who fought back, who tried to resist, but I think the overwhelming evidence today, as we speak to each other, is that the ANC has, over the last 15, 20 years, descended into a grand corrupt organization.
Because, of course, the problem is beyond just the standard corruption which you're talking about, is the ANC, maybe for the first 10 years, you could kind of say that people who were in these positions would say, well, ANC first. But as Mbeki had his fight with Zuma over some of the corruption, which he was fired for, is that the ANC kind of split, and then as it split, chunks of the state then went with it. So it turned what was a factional battle inside the ANC into one in which whole state departments and which the state bureaucracy was basically fighting factional battles of the ANC, because of the people had to not just choose an ANC, now they had to choose a faction of the ANC.
Look, the ANC has been in a state of flux since it became known that the Scorpions were investigating Jacob Zuma, who was the deputy president. The ANC has been in a state of flux since GEAR was adopted as a macroeconomic policy, which led to enormous conflict within the party in 1996. So, you know, I think there's a strong argument to be made that the ANC has never been unified since 1994. You know, it's a party that encompasses, you know, almost every strand and flavor of ideology under the sun, from hard leftists to naked capitalists and everything in between and everyone in between. So there have been chunks that have been breaking off over the last 20, 25 years with quite monotonous regularity. And I think what we're seeing now is the fissures in the party, these divisions, you know, it's just becoming more and more acute. And as we're getting closer to an expiry date for the ANC, or at least a date where, you know, they've lost 17 percentage points at the last poll, you never say never, but it's going to be very difficult for them to claw that back. You know, and as we reach a point where our politics will normalize, you know, you'll see a much more acute assault on state resources. And you know, you refer to chunks of the state and government. You know, there are certain areas of the state and government that are, you know, that are run like ANC fiefdoms, and certainly they try to maintain control of that.
And of course, you see it in the way, even at provincial or local government level, the way that the ANC has held on to Gauteng, for example, even though it has this very low voter turnout, and also the city of Johannesburg this morning, actually an article in the Daily Maverick talking about literally just listing the cadres that are running the water department or water board or whatever it is in the city, in the middle of a in the middle of what might become a sort of day zero scenario for Gauteng, but with no qualified water engineers but lots and lots of people affiliated to the party.
Yeah, well, look, that's one of the more toxic functions of curry deployment. That over the course of many years, you've had people being appointed into positions that, first of all, they're not qualified for, and they are given these positions purely because of their party affiliation. A decision taken at a deployment committee at a local level or a regional level or a national level, you know, and that's been the problem of service delivery, and that's been the problem of bureaucracy and good governance. If you look at the Auditor General's reports every single year when they audit local municipalities and local government structures, you know, how many of this country's 274 municipalities received a clean audit last year? Less than a third, much less than a third. And that's been the big problem in this country for the last 20, 25, 30 years. Because local government is where that's the closest that people get to government. Roads, water, electricity, that type of thing. Rubbish removal, you know, sidewalks, that type of thing. And it's been absolutely massacred by bureaucrats that aren't up to the job. But they owe their loyalty to the party, they owe their loyalty to the ANC, and that's why they were appointed. And often, you know, there is a relationship between individuals like that, supply chains at local municipalities, linked back to the party. So there's a whole ecosystem around corrupt and failing municipalities linked to the ANC, and as I argue in the book, at the center of that is cadre deployment.
Now, Peter, your book covers in really quite a granular detail the Zuma years, sort of how Zuma arrived and then took over, and you know, the Guptas and Waterkloof and Gordhan and all of these people, and I think that listeners will be familiar with some of that story, but it kind of happened in this big haze. And I think what you're starting to see now and what your chapter seems to represent is a kind of a consolidation of the memory of that time. But what I want to know is, like, there was almost this sense of relief when Zuma is removed and we move into the Ramaphosa years, the first few years that Cyril Ramaphosa took over. Do you think that business, maybe the media, just civil society in general, was maybe so relieved that Zuma was now gone that maybe they gave Cyril Ramaphosa a little bit of a free pass when he came in, that maybe shouldn't have done because of the fact that this is an organizational question, not actually connected necessarily completely to one individual?
Well, Benji, let's just take a step back about the context. I think the book also tries to contextualize the Zuma years in between the Mandela and Mbeki years and the Ramaphosa years. Because like I said, you can't disconnect Mandela and Mbeki from Zuma and Ramaphosa. You know, that's what came later. They're all interconnected, and it's all part of an ANC continuum. And if you look at the warning signs, if you look at the red lights that were flashing during that period, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, this was all part of an ANC project that was started in the 1990s. So that's the context. Another part another piece of context is, you know, once Mbeki left the political stage, I think the whole country breathed a sigh of relief, and I think people forget that. I think people were happy to see the end of Mbeki, and also said, look, we know that Zuma is problematic, but, you know, the guy connects with normal people. Let's give him a chance. That was the zeitgeist of the moment, and we forget that. And again, with Ramaphosa too, we were so happy to see the end of the back of Zuma, you know, that we were so chuffed to get someone of Ramaphosa's caliber in the union buildings and in Paynes. And, you know, personally, I felt that too. I mean, Ramaphosa was, you know, someone that understood constitutionalism. You know, he helped write our final constitution. You know, he led a campaign, you know, nominally against Zuma. So I think we were all positive about the change that was coming. And, you know, to be fair, Ramaphosa did start well. You know, he funded the Zondo Commission to the hilt. He appointed a number of commissions of inquiry into SARS, the National Prosecuting Authority, the Public Investment Corporation. You know, he made some, you know, he cleaned out cabinet, largely cleaned out cabinet from the Zuma holdovers. But he didn't go far enough. He didn't consolidate the support that he had. He didn't execute like he should have. And I think that's the big problem with Cyril Ramaphosa. You know, he remains a party man through and through. And I think, you know, when ANC leaders in the state and in government are confronted with decisions where it's about the national interest versus the interest of the party, 99 times out of 100, whether it's Cyril Ramaphosa or anyone else, they will choose the interest of the party before the interest of the country.
So, I mean, Pete, at a personal level then, at what point did you start to look at Cyril Ramaphosa and say, maybe something is not completely kosher here?
Look, Benji, you know, I think after the 2019 election, I started thinking, look, maybe Cyril Ramaphosa is not the guy that we need. Ahead of the 2019 election, his advisors, whom we speak to as journalists on a regular basis, on an off the record basis, you know, you meet a guy at Rosebank at a coffee shop or whatever, and you know, they may try to give you insight into what the planning is and what the ideas behind the president's decisions are. And ahead of the 2019 election, Benji, the message from the president's advisors were very clear. He needs a new mandate from the electorate, and once he gets a new mandate, then he will start to move. Then he will really start to clean house. He will clean up the ANC. He will clean up the state and government, and we'll probably see a much more decisive president. But the ANC got a large scare at the 2019 election. They fell from 62%. To 57% support. Now that was a big shock for the party, which for the rest of us it wasn't a big shock given the debauchery and the depravity of the Zuma years. But he got a big fright. He was scared to move. You know, he was scared to really start cleaning house. And then you saw a president who started taking decisions in the ANC's interest, in factions of the ANC's interest. And that's a problem. You know, when you've got a head of state, the fealty should be to the Constitution first. Fealty should be to the country at large, not a faction of the governing party. And that's unfortunately the trap into which Cyril Ramaphosa fell. And then secondly, you know, I was at a roundtable discussion in his office last year, you know, 3 hours at the union buildings in the cabinet room, where we sat around the table and really, you know, thrashed out some very difficult issues in society and in government. It was an off-the-record conversation, but when I left the president's office at 9 o'clock that night, or 8 o'clock that night, whatever it was, I just thought to myself, you know, our political leadership, my feeling is, you know, and my perception is that they're out of touch with what's really happening at grassroots level with normal South Africans. So, you know, and add to that an ANC that has been in power for 30 years. There's no way that a political party in power for 30 years with untrammeled power, I might add, you know, can still maintain the edge, can still maintain the commitment to good service delivery and good transparent governance. The ANC have obviously lost that. So I think my faith in Cyril Ramaphosa as the man of the hour, or the man for the hour rather, started faltering around 2019-2020, and most definitely by last year I was convinced that unfortunately Ramaphosa is not the guy.
Now, Peter, what you talked about at some point in this interview, which I thought very important, right? The cadres are connected to the party and connected to the state, and very often, effectively, state departments become funding mechanisms of the ANC because people are siphoning off money from the state illegally, and then that money goes to help funding the party because that's your payoff for being a cadre. Now, if we extrapolate that from provincial and local government level to a national level, couldn't we or can we extrapolate that also to an international level, the way that we operate with Cuba, for example, where Cubans are fixing the SANDF rattles and so forth, but not doing a very good job. And we know that the ANC is connected to a lot of very dodgy partners overseas. And we've seen the ANC, or the government, taking very strong international relations positions, and that seems to be seen always ideologically or as part of history. But how far can we extrapolate your thesis around the CADA deployment and the payoffs that they get into an international relations realm and the way that we're operating internationally as a country?
Look, Benji, it's a difficult question to answer. I think. You know, what we've seen with our country and, you know, our foreign policy, the way in which we relate to Russia, the way in which we relate to the BRICS countries, China specifically, our position on Israel and Gaza, you know, our antagonism towards the United States, you know, it's all rooted in the ANC's history. It's all rooted in the ANC's, I think, misguided worldview, and it's all rooted in the ANC's historic alliances, historic loyalties, which they still haven't been able to modernize, which is not a pragmatic way of positioning the country in a very, very difficult geopolitical environment at the moment. You know, but I don't foresee that changing. You know, if you talk about CADA deployment and the CADAs, you know, there's a built-in loyalty by the CADAs, by ANC cadres, by ANC leaders, towards countries that supported them during the struggle against apartheid. But Benji, 1990 is not 2024 anymore. You know, the world's changed. Alliances have shifted. We're seeing the emergence of a new multipolar world in which the United States might possibly not be the strongest country. And I don't think the ANC and their leadership have navigated this with any aplomb, and I don't think they've really come to terms with how things are changing and what is good for this country. I don't think they've always followed a foreign policy that puts the interests of this country first, rather than the interests of some or other sponsor or some or other big brother state that we try to curry favor with.
Well, there you go. Peter du Toit, thank you so much for joining us. He is the author of a new book called The Super CADAs, ANC Misrol in the Age of Deployment. It is published by Jonathan Ball and is available at all good bookshops. Peter, thank you so much for joining us on Chai FM, and best of luck with the rest of your work and the rest of the book.
Thanks, Benji. Good talking to you again, and keep well.
Thanks so much. That is Peter du Toit. Go and check out his book, The Super CADAs. I'm Benji Shulman. This is 101.9 Chai FM.